Hi, I'm Danny Elfman.
This is Shirley Manson.
This is Debbie Harry.
This is Chris Steyer Blondie.
This is Ronan Dorzabal from Tears for Fears.
This is Billy Idol.
This is Alex Ebert, a.k.a. Edward Sharp, giving the story behind the song.
Hi, this is Peter Chotti, host of The Story Behind the Song. Each month I speak to some of music's biggest artists to get the inside stories behind their most lasting and iconic songs. Join me for new episodes on the third Monday of every month on The Story Behind the Song from the Consequence Podcast Network, available wherever you get your podcasts.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Philadelphia rock band The Hooters had several arena rock hits in the 80s. All You Zombies, And We Danced, Where Do the Children Go? But before they were stars, they were a local ska band. In fact, the original Hooters were one of the first ska bands in the U.S. And while the group were still in their ska phase, they also worked with Cyndi Lauper on her debut record, She's So Unusual. Dig up some of the early demos for that album on YouTube, and you'll be surprised at the ska and reggae grooves found in those songs. Today, we tell the story of the Hooters ska period with band members Eric Bazilian and Rob Hyman. And we absolutely discuss the making of Cyndi Lauper's landmark almost ska pop album as well.
Okay, going into this one, I gotta admit, I was unfamiliar with the Hooters. However, we learned during this that they helped write so many songs that make up the fabric of my reality.
They also, I mean, they, as a band, they were so big in the 80s. Like for rock and roll.
Yeah.
And there's the ska period of the Hooters was not as well known as their rock and roll period in the 80s and 90s. So it was an important part of their development as a band.
Every band should have a ska period.
Yeah. But it doesn't have to be the first period.
No.
Yeah. It can be 15 years into the band. You can go ska.
20 years into the band.
20 years into the band. Start out playing rock and roll and then turn into a ska band.
I like that.
Yeah, that's what we propose going forward.
Every band, put out a ska album, wherever you are in your career. Just do it.
The first thing I want to talk about is there was a photo, Catbite or Eric, I can't remember. There was a photo posted of Catbite and you, Eric.
Yeah, yep.
And I asked Catbite about it. They said that they had tweeted that their favorite local ska band, they're from Philadelphia, as well as you guys, was the Hooters, and that... that I assume then you saw this tweet and then you invited them to come see you guys play.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I had heard of them, but I had never really checked them out. And I checked them out and like, wow, this is a real good band. And I just started tweeting, DMing them and invited them to the show. And they were awesome. They were so nice. And, you know, like it's just amazing that this next generation, they know about us because, you know, I mean, our ska phase has sort of come and gone and come and gone. So I didn't know that we were really regarded as that, but it actually started a whole chain reaction.
Yeah, because your ska phase is like 80s, not even the 90s.
Right, right. I mean, we really, you know, I guess Rob and I went and saw Madness, and I think it was at the Hot Club in like 79 or 80, and that was it. It was like seeing the Beatles on Ed Sullivan.
So Catbite, or I think it was Tim from Catbite, told me that at the show that he saw, which was recent, I think that's this year, you guys played a Specials cover and then you had a brand new ska song in addition to your older material.
Yep, that's right. And there's more to come, we think.
First off, what's your Specials cover that you're doing?
Rudy, Message to Rudy. And that came about, we actually had a horn section too, which was really fun. We had done that 40 years ago, actually found some cassettes of that, those days in the band, and we recreated that with the horn section. And the funny thing about Rudy is we were on tour in Germany last summer, and one of our longtime crew guys who drives the truck is named Rudy, R-U-D-I, but had never heard the song. And we were backstage one day just singing. Some of the crew knew it, and he didn't. So we had to, you know, present it. And I think one of the sound checks actually put it on as our walk-on or walk-off music. So it was a little personal inspiration to dig back. But we always loved the track. I don't think we'd have, if we played it, it kind of came and went.
Yeah, no, we never played that. We tried, we played just about every known ska song from that era back in the day, but I don't think we ever did that one.
What else were you guys covering back then?
English Beat. We did Your Best Friend from the first Beat album.
Nice.
And a lot of Scottalites, going back to the very beginning, the first thing we ever got, the first airplay we ever got in Philly was a version of Man in the Street by Scottalites. And then also off, there was a great Trojan, it's a 3-record vinyl collection. I think it was called The Trojan Story, and it was awesome. Still is awesome. And we did Soon You'll Be Gone, which was by the Blues Busters, kind of the Jamaican Sam and Dave. They were a duo, and a bunch of other things. Just can't figure out some reggae stuff, but you know.
The Israelites. We did The Israelites.
Nice.
Israelites. Good version of that. And then, you know, we would take other, like For Your Love by the Yardbirds. We scod that out. And it was a whole night of this. We used to call it the skanking army. Or, you know, fans would come. And if you look, there's stuff on YouTube. It's, some of it's a little cringy to look. But the music was not, you know, I mean, some of the get-ups and hairdos, whatever. But we had a lot of upbeats all night long.
So this new song that Tim mentioned.
Yeah.
When did you write this new ska song?
In the spring.
Yeah, recently. It took a while, and it just kind of landed in that direction. And then we play this theater outside Philly called the Keswick, and we every November or early fall, mid-fall, and we debuted it with the horns, and Eric plays sax in the band as well, but we had a horn section to augment the sound, and it was mighty. It felt great.
What's the name of the song?
Why Won't You Call Me Back?
Was there an inspiration behind playing ska again?
You know, I've been sort of pushing for it for a while because our drummer David Wasikinen, that's his superpower. It's like when he first joined the band, he was a rock drummer. I don't think he'd ever heard of ska or reggae, but it was like he was born to do that. You know, he could do the kick drum on 2 and 4 thing. And he could do that side stick, the crazy side stick thing with the quarter note kick drum. And that's still his superpower. And, you know, I just wanted to give him a chance to do that again. And the challenge was, and, you know, and Rob pointed this out, and I think it was very, very, very astute, is that we didn't want to be going back in time. If we're going to start doing more ska and reggae, it's got to be, you know, it's got to be an evolution rather than a regression. Thank you. But this song just sort of evolved, and we realized, yep, this is the poster child for whatever the next phase may be.
So okay, so it's 2021 and it's 2022. The Hooters play. Audience comes. You go through your set. When you get to the couple ska songs, what is the audience reaction?
They start throwing things. No. No. Well,
a thick cloud of smoke.
Yeah, well, the audience is a mix, too. I mean, we think about this all the time because there are the hardcore fans that remember this version of the band, which was a very different version of the band. It was ska, reggae, rock all night long. And now we have morphed in over the years and the audience has changed, et cetera. So there's some hardcore fans, usually in the front row, that go all the way back. And then there's, honestly, kids coming, you know, kids meaning their kids or just a younger generation. So it's all new to them. But I think whether they even know it as ska or not, it's kind of like all our stuff. Like we really have mixed a lot of sounds and genres together. And
yeah,
it's the bottom line is the songs and the performance. Like the band live 40 plus years, we feel like it's better than ever. You know, we work hard to keep it at that level, but we've refined it and we've really tweaked it. We're now a 6-piece, and so we're always a 5-piece. And with 6, you know, guys on hand, we can just do a lot more sonically and vocally. So it's just the sound that we've had, and it has evolved. But there are those that go all the way back, and then there's some that are new. But, you know, as Dick Clark said, if it's got a good beat, you know, if you can dance to it kind of thing. So, and it did. In fact, the horn, it was almost to the day, 40 years since we had done this way back when. And we used to play a club in South Philly. We had a kind of a residency there and other clubs as well, where we tried out the horns. We recently found a cassette of that show to the day, November 5th, 1982. And we're doing some of the same songs. Well, at least Man in the Street, et cetera. So people dug it. You know, it's timeless.
Yeah. I want to go back to the very beginning. So most bands from your era, and you mentioned this, you saw Madness. It was a huge moment for you as a band. But Rob, you go back even further with ska. I think this is unusual for a lot of U.S. people who started ska bands in the 80s. You discovered ska in the 60s as a child from a family vacation to Jamaica.
I did. It was very formative. A friend of my dad's, I grew up in Meriden, Connecticut, a little town up in New England. And you know, it's cold, it's winter. And a friend of my dad's, a schoolmate of his, I think, had a small hotel in Montego Bay. He was partners in. And it was kind of funky, but it was in Jamaica way back when. And a partner and this guy found a property and invited us down for a Christmas vacation. Five of us in my family had an older sister and I have a younger brother. And it was like, okay, Christmas, we're going to Jamaica. And it was really, I keep saying, it was like going to the moon. It was just, you get off the plane, it was hot and humid. You get this blast. You see these Rastas dressed up like Santa Claus. I hear these Christmas carols being sung in these crazy beats that I found out later what it was, et cetera. So it was a whole new world, still very much English influence in terms of there was like shillings and pence and money. So it was very foreign, very strange, and a lot of fun. And their property, in fact, the friend of the friend had this house high on top of this hill overlooking Montego Bay. I mean, it's an incredible property. I think it's now a school or a monastery or something. But back in the day, it was a home. We went and, you know, we drove around. We rented this tiny little car, crowded in a little stick shift. And we started hearing this music on the radio. And there was one song in particular called Sammy Dead that was a big hit. And we didn't understand the words, but it had a real catchy chorus and this crazy beat. And so while I was listening to, I guess, Beatles and Stones, you know, mid-60s, being doing the rock thing as we all were and of our generation, I heard this crazy mixed up music, you know, down there, mixed up in terms of the, you know, the rhythms and the beats, and it caught my ear. So I kind of was on a quest to find Sammy Dead, and I did. It was like there was a little gift shop that sold some records, and I bought an album called Ska Authentic by the Skatalites, which I still have and cherish to this day. And the cover was awesome because it shows the guys in the studio. And a lot of times there were just graphics and, you know, some kind of visual thing. But, you know, for us, and I'm sure for Eric, once we started getting into rock music, it was all about the liner notes and the pictures and what really goes on. We were already into that level of, you know, what does a producer do and who played on this, et cetera. So the cover is these guys, the band in this, it had to be hot. They were sweating away. You know, I just imagine the sessions down there. And they're just playing live in the studio. It was kind of like Hitsville of Detroit or something. One of those scenes. Found the album with Sammy Dead. And it's a compilation. Tommy McCook and Lee Perry, a very fresh cut, clean cut. Lee Perry was on there. Delroy Wilson, the Maytals. It was like just a compilation of all these songs, I guess, basically backed up by Skatalites.
I was looking up the Sammy Dead, and I think there's different versions, but I think Eric Monte Morris is the one I found to be, yes, probably the most common. That's the one that you heard?
I think so. Yeah, it had this great intro, this horn line. And then, Sammy Dead in the gully. And there's different versions. You need the version where the background go, oh, because we would drive around in the car and just sing along. You know, my brother was, I think, 7 or 8. I was in my teens, early teens. It was just a funny, crazy thing. And honestly, the rest is history. Kept going back. We went back to this particular hotel several years in a row for Christmas. It was really fun, and then kind of moved on, and then been going down and collecting albums ever since. A lot of vinyl from some late great stores.
So you found there was one store in Montego Bay that was not in the tourist part of the town called Clappers that you used to frequent in the 70s?
Yes, I did. And they would stamp their name, you know, like the I would get 45s or albums. I would eventually just venture into Montego Bay, clearly like the only tourist back then. I mean, since those years, they built a dock for cruise ships and all this stuff. But way back when, it was like nobody, most tourists didn't go into the city of Montego or beyond. And we actually explored the island pretty extensively because another friend had written a book about driving and maps all over that he had explored. Another American had explored the whole island. So we had this book of different places to go. Went out to Negril before it was even Negril. There was literally one hotel that was just getting started. And the rest is history there, too. So I would kind of venture around and yeah, picked up records. I'd walk into the shop and they would, I'd say, what's out? And they would just start, like the old days, even like record shops here, I guess. They'd just say, oh, check out this, check out that. There'd be a whole counter full of 45s and albums, and I would take as much as I could afford, especially into my later years. You know, and then the Wailers, then everyone started to hit. But I came at it from the early days, you know, before it turned into reggae and all of that.
Do you still have any of those 45s that you collected from those days?
Many of them, yeah. They're very cherished. I have some great ones.
Name a couple prized possessions from this era.
Oh, wow. I have a jukebox, too, which is now sadly broken, but I had a whole section of the 45s that are in the jukebox. Barrington Levy, Prison Oval Rock was a good one. Prince Buster, original Madness single. Then it got into, well, stuff we started to cover, which was Michigan and Smiley, Nice Up the Dance, some Bunny Wailer, some reggae, or some Bob Marley. The early ska stuff was really, really just, it was already starting to morph into reggae-ness, but I still have a lot of vinyl. Yeah. Justin Hines and the Dominoes, Heptones. I don't know. It's a lot.
Yeah.
Good stuff, especially the 45s. They had such a sound. Sometimes they're printed off center. They had funky labels. They had this little stamper. They would put Clappers on there. And I went back many years later. Apparently, it's somewhere they said the store was still there a couple years ago because I've been going back lately as well. And the store was gone, but I found some CDs that were really old vinyl that were kind of digitized and stuff. So it's amazing how much stuff there's, like any, you know, genre, it's a deep well. There's a lot of stuff still to discover.
So Rob and Eric, you guys met in 1971 at the University of Pennsylvania.
Wow. When you put it like that, it seems so long.
Eric, did you discover reggae and Jamaican music from Rob, or did you independently discover reggae?
I knew about it. It's funny. The first time I ever heard the word reggae was probably 1970. There was a British band called The Move. And one of their albums, my favorite of their albums called Shazam, has all these bizarre little audio tidbits. And one of them is they're just interviewing people on the street. And he's talking to some guy and he asks him, what kind of music do you like? Reggae. What? Reggae. That's my music. And that's the first time I ever heard the word reggae. And around the same time, I went to Toronto with my parents to visit my aunt. And we were in a store in Yorkville, which at the time was like the new place for hippies, which is now crazily gentrified. But I remember seeing a little poster for a reggae band. So this is the first time I saw the word reggae in writing. And then the first time I remember hearing it, I guess Rob must have turned me onto it early on. But there was I had a girlfriend who was way into it, and she played me Catch a Fire, which would have been 73, I guess. So that was the first time I really listened. I listened, you know, top to bottom to a reggae album and went like, oh yeah, something going on here.
So I know Rob, I'm not sure, I can't remember if you were in these bands or not, Eric, but I know that Rob, you were in the band Wax and then Baby Grand.
Mm-hmm.
Baby Grand had a song called Lady of My Dreams that had a little bit of a reggae element. Was that the first or really only pre-Hooters time where you were introducing that music into your 70s bands?
I think so. Eric was involved in Baby Grand as well. And
okay.
There was an earlier version of that song that was several versions, as is our It's our pattern. Sometimes we go too far, but whatever, we tend to keep tinkering with things. And I wanted to bring that influence in. The band was much more of a prog rocking kind of vehicle, so it wasn't quite the thing. In fact, it really led to when we put the Hooters together, it was clearly that was part of what was happening. But yeah, Eric, you can help me. I think that was about the only reggae tune we did.
Yep.
And that's loosely speaking, you know, I mean, Steely Dan had, you know, Haitian Divorce and all of that. It was starting to bubble under, but no, we weren't really playing that much in that group.
Yeah. I think Lady of My Dreams, which was another song before that, it was almost 20, and it wasn't broken and you fixed it. But right. I think it was kind of more reggae, but that's just, it kind of evolved into more of the Steely Danny kind of a vibe than the authentic reggae thing.
And what happened was we did two albums on Arista, about to do a third. We started touring. We weren't, you know, we thought, oh, major record deal. Our dreams are, you know, are answered. Yeah. We're there. Well, kids, it doesn't always work that way. Two records later, massively in debt, tour support, advances. The best thing, we had a great lawyer at the time, and his advice was get off the label, get dropped, which was like, get dropped. We've worked so hard to get signed. We want to do a third album. And they're like, no, just break away, which we did eventually. We tried, you know, it was an interesting band and we had some great players, but we just didn't have that hit or that commercial success. And when the band dissolved, it kind of as the band dissolved, Eric and I kind of moved to the side. We're now into the close to 1980, and the Police come out, and Two Tone, and the Specials, and Hizzy Said Madness, and Selector, and the writing was on the wall. Saw Bob Marley as well at the Tower. Great concert, several times. Saw Bob in Philly, and it was just like, Eric, we got to do this. And Eric, he was already in, and it was just, we changed our whole vibe. The band, that was all we did. So I think the timing was such, and the Police being at the top of the heap, also saw them at the Tower, which is a great theater in Philly. And these bands, you know, right when they were about to break, playing at 2,500 seat before they went to, you know, bigger and better. Bigger anyway. It was just seeing these bands, whether in a club or a theater, that just were doing it. And in America, yeah, I mean, you know, there was always this kind of reggae scene in England. We'd been listening to it for years on that kind of just as our secret passion. But it was just obvious we got to get out there and play this stuff.
So seeing Madness, that Madness show you're describing, I don't know if it was 79 or 80, but did it give you permission, or was seeing how this Jamaican music could be blended with rock music, was that some of it?
Absolutely.
Yeah. And the energy, it was just, you know, the thing about I guess the reason reggae didn't really grab me from the beginning was just because, you know, I wanted more energy. I wanted more guitars. I wanted different kind of sweat. And then seeing Madness, and then we saw the Selector shortly thereafter. That was what I've been looking for. That was the key for me to bring my heart into it.
And then there was also a great club in Philly called Emerald City. It was really South Jersey, actually, right over the bridge in Jersey. It was originally called the Latin Casino, and it was kind of a Frank Sinatra, you know, casino, Atlantic City kind of place. They had like those kind of acts, and then closed, and they opened it up in the 80s as this alternative. It was a great place, different rooms to just hang out, and they had, you know, a lot of alternative music. And we started playing there, and then we opened for the English Beat and hung out with them. That was another big influence, because they were to the rockier side of things. You know, they had Ranking Roger and Saxon, all the reggae-ness, but they also had kind of a more of a rock approach. We played with them. We also played with Steel Pulse, who were fantastic, still, you know, listen to their stuff all the time, which was more kind of progressive and not just two chords and a groove, but pretty complex, some of their stuff. And they were amazing live. So we started to play literally open for these bands, and the audience just grew, and we just kept, you know, pushing it on. And even it was new to people, but it started to break, and it was a lot of fun. I mean, it was really, those were special times for us.
So as the Hooters, the first song you wrote, even like technically before you played your first show, was All You Zombies?
One of the first, yep. And Fighting on the Same Side, which is a ska thing. And Eric had brought also, and key to this was the melodica. A friend of Eric said, I guess it was, well, Eric, you tell the story. It was your...
Yeah, so there was a, I had some friends who had a band that I was producing and playing on, and they had a melodica, and I played it on one of our tracks. I played that for Rob, and Rob pulls out his Augustus Pablo album. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, can you, why don't you bring that over? So I did, and history.
We were doing a demo tape. We had a place, a little rehearsal place. It started with Baby Grand, and then it morphed into the Hooters in a place called Manayunk, which is a suburb of Philly, also now very gentrified, but back in the day, very funky. And, you know, any rock band knows it's hard to find a place where you can make noise and not get arrested or, you know, shut down. And we did our first night. The cops came, but it was, we wrote and conceived of the band and did some recordings in that place of Fighting on the Same Side, Man in the Street, All You Zombies, all the way back in 1980. And a friend of ours, John Sr., who's an engineer, was getting recording levels. And he said, let me hear that Hooter thing. And we're like, what are you talking about? And so he called it a Hooter. And then, of course, it was a melodica, which we now call the Hooters. And like the sidebar is, no, we did not name ourselves after the restaurant.
The restaurant didn't exist in 1980, right?
No.
Yeah, okay. That's what I thought.
No, and we always have to clarify. At this point, it's just, we are the Hooters. It's not the Hooters. And, you know, it was a musical reference, but the melodica was figured prominently on Fighting on the Same Side. That was the very first 45 we ever did. We went to a studio and recorded that with Bill Whitman, who was a great engineer, is still a great engineer, that did Cindy's album and Joan, a lot of Hooters stuff, Nervous Night as well. So we're on our way. Yeah.
What was the B-side on that first 45?
The B-side was actually called Wireless, is Wireless. And it was a tribute to Bob Marley, who had just passed away while we were, or shortly after when we recorded that. And it's actually a tribute to him. And it's kind of about, that's an interesting song. It's a tricky one. It's got a little bit of a Steel Pulse vibe to the arrangement. There's some interesting rhythm cuts and things. So Fightin' and Wireless was the first 45, which we dedicated to the memory of Bob. Yeah, which was, of course, a sad passing, but a big influence on us.
Yeah.
Man in the Street as well. I mean, we had a cassette from that first demo. Maybe I mentioned it. That was the first time we ever got airplay in Philly on, you know, back in the day, they would take more chances with local bands. And they played our demo of Man in the Street. A DJ named Michael Tierson played in this ska instrumental, which we are still playing to this day. And people loved it.
And he didn't just play it once. It went into regular rotation.
Nice.
And at the time, I think that was the time we were doing a residency at a club called Grendel's Lair on South Street in Philadelphia. We were playing every Monday night. And that, I think that was around the time that came out.
Yep.
That they started playing that. And, you know, the first week, Monday we played, there were 50 people. The second, there were 100. And within a couple of months, there was a line around the block. And it really had a lot to do with the airplay we were getting.
Most people that are fans of ska have heard the original Skatalites version. It goes, it's with horns, though. It goes, da-na, da-da-da-da-da-da. You know, so I think that's a pretty well-known song. But you didn't have horns, so you used electric guitars.
And saxophone. I played a saxophone.
Oh, you did? Yeah, that's right.
And I had been playing saxophone for 2 weeks.
But I mean, that main horn line you guys do with the electric guitars. Yeah.
In the beginning and at the end, it's one electric guitar and the sax.
Nice.
Ah, okay.
Well, we made it. Yeah, Eric and there was another guitar player. We had two lead guitars and they did the whole thing in harmony, the horn lines in harmony. And then there's this melodica solo, a sax solo, as Eric said, and a guitar. And it was exactly just electrifying that beat, picked up the tempo, and we were making it our own with most of this stuff. You know, it was kind of the covers we did were just more rock versions with guitars, exactly.
Yeah, the guitars are really shreddy on that track.
Yeah.
Yeah, we just heard it recently. You know, it's so funny because... And if people can, I guess, find it, dig it up. But it actually goes, Man in the Street, take one. And it was take one. And it's such a great performance and a great recording. Actually, a local DJ just played it in Philly on WMMR, which is our big rock station. They still squeeze us in sometime. This late night jock, who's a great friend and fan, went on and on about Man in the Street, and I hadn't heard it on the radio. I don't remember, but if I did, it was a long time ago. So he played it, and it was a cassette. It was literally mastered from a cassette onto it. We added it to a CD later on, but those cassettes held up, and it sounds great. You know, we caught the performance totally live, first take, and we were on our way.
What, real quick sidebar, what do you guys think about the younger generation going back to wanting things on cassette?
I'm for analog. Well, it's funny you mentioned that, because we've been digging through. We're actually putting together a project. I don't want to get ahead of myself, but we're going back to our roots, because we wrote a new song and because we played Rudy and some of the old songs at this recent gig, a couple gigs. It spurred us into thinking that there's something here, because the people do like it, either the old fans or the new ones. We went back, we're at Eric's studio, and we're both big collectors of various things. And we're finding that we had tons of stuff on DAT, for example. None of them are playing. The players are dead, or the cassettes are dead. We're looking at floppy drive, firewire drives, the technology is such that a lot of this stuff is not accessible anymore. And I collect still a lot of vinyl and cassettes. And I have to say, the cassettes still play. If you can find a boombox or a little cassette player, whatever, they're holding up pretty well along with vinyl. So it's not so much an audio thing as just the ability that they still work. And I like it. I think it's great that people are going back to that.
Yeah.
Vinyl, for sure. I mean, it's a medium, you know, listen, it takes time and effort to put a record on and take it off and all of that. But there's nothing like holding an album, looking at the liner notes. It just smells a certain way. You know, it just, for us, it's nostalgic because that's what we grew up with.
Well, and also, I mean, from a vinyl standpoint, just having the artwork on the front of the album that big is so nice.
It's awesome. I mean, like I said, we used to pore over the credits, produced by and this and that and mastered by. Like, what does that mean? What's a producer? What's mastering? You know,
we're still all asking ourselves that. What is mastering?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's true. No, it's great. And I mean, it transcends, you know, I mean, kids, you know, I've got two boys in their late 20s, one's 30 now, and they're stealing all my albums as well as getting their own. And they're totally into it. And the bands that they go see are selling vinyl or there's downloads, you know, I mean, CDs are pretty much done in their world. I remember I used to give them CDs for Christmas or whatever, and they would rip the CD and give it back to me. It's like, thanks, Dad, here you go. They have no need for the plastic, you know, and really it's like save the world and we don't need more of that. So but vinyl's a different story, and we hunt through the bins and we're always looking for stuff, and that really plays. I mean, I have old jazz and all my reggae stuff. It plays amazingly well and it sounds great, especially the pressings from Jamaica. I mean, those records, there's no way to get bass response that like the records that you get from down there. I don't know how they did it, honestly, with the technology or limited, you know, means of that. But man, those records are really punchy and pretty great.
Yeah. I remember, like, because I grew up, I was a kid in the 80s, and there's something about having like a handful of cassettes and your Walkman and you're going on whatever trip you're going on.
Right.
Like, it's hard to like, yeah, it's hard to like let go of that sort of feeling that you get from that. I mean, I guess kids who grow up in a later generation can think about having an iPod similarly, but the fact that you had to pick out like however many, like five or six or whatever tapes. Yeah.
I think the other part of it was, and I guess the concept still exists, but the whole idea of mixtapes and you know, making your own. And when it was, as Eric mentioned, with these shows we did at this club, Grendel's Lair, every Monday night, they were nonstop reggae dance parties. Like, we would make our own mixtapes for the breaks. We would play three or four sets a night, 45 minutes maybe, and the music never stopped. So when we took a break, we would pop in a cassette of all our favorite stuff, dub mixes and, you know, obscure stuff. And it was nonstop for hours of this stuff. And it really appealed to a pretty mixed and diverse crowd. You know, we had all kinds of people coming to these shows. And I recently found some of the mixtapes as well. And I remember going to Jamaica and bringing music down a little, not even a boombox, a little, you know, cassette player and some tapes to Jamaica just to listen. We were so immersed in it, but there was that whole idea of you're exactly right, carrying the cassettes around. Obviously you could play them in your car. The Walkman was our thing, and also to document ideas and record stuff. Just playing these tapes. And, you know, I guess it still exists in a digital form, but they were literally mixtapes and they were part of our show. It was nonstop.
And part of our repertoire. We had a song called Walkman.
Yes, we did.
Which was a great part of our show. It was actually one of the high points of our show. And we have a really good recording of it that's never been heard.
Oh, we're going to have to release that then.
We're messing with, that's what we've been digging into. We've been listening to these. Eric did all the original demos. Well, some were live, and then he got a Porta studio that as well, so we started doing these four track tapes, and there's some beautiful stuff on there. It was just purely, you know, right into the machine and pushing the technology on that little cassette, four track cassette. Sounds pretty good. Holds up okay.
Now I was curious. Michael Tierson, you guys mentioned him.
Yep.
Yes.
He's the DJ that started playing Man in the Streets.
Yes.
Really took a liking to the song. Do you know, did he have any familiarity with ska, or did he just hear it and fall in love with it, your version of it?
Good question. He was a very knowledgeable DJ. Eric was from the Philly area. I moved down to go to school, that's when I got introduced to him. And he was one of those encyclopedias of everything. He was playing great stuff way back when. So maybe he did. But I think what happened actually for the band, I was talking about this club, Emerald City in Jersey. We did a live radio broadcast on MMR, which was still is the big rock station in Philly. And those were the days, you know, they gave us like an hour of airtime to do this live recording. We had a version of All You Zombies that started to get airplay. But Man in the Street was part of that whole scene. They were supporting us. So I don't know if he was familiar with ska per se. Knowing Michael, he probably was, because he was very knowledgeable in all his genres. But we do feel like we were bringing this to fresh ears in a lot of these cases. You know, I mean, this was early on and a bigger scene in England than in the States. So
yeah,
maybe that's why it needs more defending over here.
Sure.
I doubt ska needs much defense in England, but who knows? I mean, I guess as a genre, it comes and goes, or the style, but really, it is a genre. It's like saying defending the blues or jazz. It's here to stay. You know, you get together with a bunch of guys and you might say, let's play it like a blues, or let's play it like a reggae, or let's play it like a ska. There's a style. That's the other thing about it for me is we witnessed, you know, firsthand this style developing into a genre, and that's not easy to create and do. So,
yeah.
we were certainly part of we were the messengers there, but, Michael came along for the ride. He was a big fan.
So in the couple of years in the early 80s, when you were more enmeshed in the ska, creating ska songs and stuff and playing ska, did you see any other bands in the Philly area or even the larger region dabble in this music?
Well, reggae, you had the House of Assembly was like the authentic Jamaican reggae band in Philadelphia. Then we did a show in Richmond, Virginia, and there was a ska band there. I think they were on the bill with us.
Yes, the Good Guys.
The Good Guys, yep. And we became friends with them. Yep.
Yep. And it was the same kind of a two-tone scene. You know, it was an interracial band. It was kind of the black-white mixture. As were we, of just genres and styles and everyone, and even just in terms of how they dressed, how they looked. Yeah, that's true. That was a band that we played with. Otherwise, there weren't, I don't remember many ska bands. Definitely reggae was coming along for sure.
Okay, so All You Zombies, this song would eventually get re-released in the mid-80s in a more rock form, but the very first version of this was written in 1980. And as I've heard you describe it in multiple interviews, the song just sort of came, you know, these words and the songs just came to you without much explanation. But from what I understand, the very first line that came to you was, "All you people hide your face, all you people in the street."
That's right. That's in my recollection. That's how it was. Yep.
When these lines entered your head, did it mean anything to you?
Good question. We're still asking that question.
It's funny because Rob sang it. He played and sang it. I remember we were jamming. We weren't really getting anywhere. And all of a sudden, Rob plays D minor, A minor, C and G and goes, "All you people, show your faces." I might have gone, "All you people in the street." I'm not sure. But it was we knew we were on a ride. We were on a magic carpet ride.
And so you changed people to zombies. Was that an immediate decision?
That was the next day. So I think, Rob, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think we wrote the verses that the first day when it was all you people. And that was a whole wackadoodle thing too. I heard this voice like Paul Robeson, you know, the great spiritual singers. I heard his voice singing, "Holy Moses met the Pharaoh." And so we had the entire song, except it was all you people. We came in the next day and Rob said, "It needs to be something else." And I said, "Yeah, what else should it be?" And Rob said, "How about all you zombies?" Which was perfect. And there was a familiarity to me with that title. And it took me a year before I realized that it was the title of a science fiction story by Robert Heinlein. Mm. Robert A. Heinlein, who wrote, you know, Stranger in a Strange Land, among many others.
Yeah.
It was a wackadoodle time travel paradox story that I had read in seventh grade. And it took me years to find it. This was pre-internet. You know, now you can, it's everywhere. But it was just some wacky synchronicity that Rob, who had never read, I don't think had ever read any science fiction at all, comes up with this title.
It did evolve. And really, when we people do ask, you know, what it's about. And it is one of those songs that has this mystery. Is it religious? Is it, you know, apocalyptic? I guess it's all of those. But it definitely was hooky. We played it at our very first show. And the funny thing about it, too, is, again, these early clubs, we would do, it was like boot camp for us. There was a club up in Levittown, which PA, which is a suburb of Philly, where our drummer and the rest of the guys of the original band really were from, and a place called Vernon's. And we would play there four nights a week or five, you know, four sets a night. And Zombies, we were playing, but we would do it early on to kind of get it out of the way, so to speak. I clearly remember that because, like, it was a little bit of a head scratcher. Like, we liked it, but it also seemed like, let's do the weird stuff early because then the people are going to want to, you know, we mixed. We also did Joe Jackson. We did some Tom Petty. We did some other rock covers to mix it in. We brought the people in slowly to the ska and reggae stuff, and especially to the original stuff. I mean, we had Fighting and Zombies, but it was still like a lot of covers, et cetera. And Zombies was kind of a throwaway song. And then going back to that Emerald City broadcast, we played it live on the radio, and there was another disc jockey that was on more of a top 40 station in Philly. And we met him somewhere, or he got in touch with us, and he said, "What's that song, all you people in the street?" He grabbed right to it. We still didn't know what we had, which is why sometimes you want a good producer or A&R guy or just an outside opinion, because it was this quirky little song, but he was like, that's the song. And he was kind of right. That was the song. And sometimes, you know, it's right in front of you, but you don't realize it.
Now, you've had some controversy with the song over the years, radio stations, like religious, maybe banning the song.
Yeah.
Is it just because of the usage of zombie? Is that what, I mean, because zombies now are way more ubiquitous in
right. Yeah.
Everyone's so used to zombies. But in the 80s, I could think of, like, that was a little bit more subversive.
Like I don't
zombie
know.
Zombie movies. Yeah.
I don't know that there was that much negative reaction. In fact, I remember I interviewed with several Christian magazines about the song. They loved it.
Oh, so they thought it was like had a religious message.
And they liked the fact that it was written by two non-practicing Hebrews.
Well, there was some did, but I clearly remember some didn't. I mean, it was also banned on a few stations, which we thought was awesome. That was the height of, you know, excitement to be banned by whatever, whomever. There was some controversy. I think it was just the religious, you know, imagery and what we were trying to say or not. You know, it had this apocalyptic vibe. So there were some people. It didn't faze us. We took it all. And I guess, yeah, maybe there were some positive responses in that world too. You know, we weren't going after those particular stations for airplay. but people still ask us, you know, they want to know what it's about. And that's great when those things happen. It happens. It really was written quickly. It was one of those songs that did just drop into our laps like the good ones rarely do. But that's beautiful when it happens.
Yes, I mean, songwriting, happens differently and with different songs. Sometimes you have an intention, but sometimes songs just sort of fall into your brain and you can't necessarily, it's like your subconscious is working You're just spitting out what your subconscious is telling you. So you can't really explain an intention when a song is coming from your subconscious.
Right. It's like saying this child we're about to give birth to is going to be a doctor.
Well, the other side of it is there were several songs that that fall in that genre thematically, what we would call Bible stories. There was some religious connotation. Satellite was one that was about inspired by, you know, the TV evangelist. That was more of a direct inspiration. We kind of knew what we were writing about in that case, and kind of satirically, we're still playing that one. And then, of course, Eric, with One of Us, talking about song dropping into your lap, what we like to call the 10-minute song. You know, it should sound like it was written in 10 minutes, even if it wasn't. But, we were working with Joan Osborne, and one day Eric came and said, hey, I got a song I just wrote. Yeah, while we were banging our heads against the wall in four-way writing committees with Joan and Rick, our Chernoff, our producer, and in walks Eric with One of Us, and the same thing. There's some mystery to that, for sure, and more religious imagery and thematic concepts there. You know, we like those Bible stories.
Yeah, they've been very good to us.
Can I ask some questions about the video really quick? Where was this shot?
It was shot at Hammersmith Pumping Station in London, which I guess wasn't being used anymore. It was a vacant pumping station.
Uh-huh. Yeah, we were so lucky. That was our first trip overseas. It was in 85. Nervous Night was just coming out. It's a long story there, but that was picked as the first single, which is, again, what a crazy ride that song has, and also different versions. But the idea was that I guess the U.S. dollar was pretty strong versus the pound. And the record company said it was actually affordable and desirable to send us to London to do a video. And we're like, okay. And the director, Donald Camel, was like a really serious, he did performance with Mick Jagger and some other movies. I mean, the guy was like a real, we've been very fortunate to work with some fantastic directors back in the day. And he was a film director, and he had the vision, found this. I think you're right, Eric. I don't think it was still active, but it was this underground pumping station. And you feel it in the video, but, you know, when you're actually in there and it's just this cold, damp, you know, big industrial space. He had the drums on this. You see it in the video, but it was this giant, heavy platform they would use to raise, I guess, and, you know, move machinery. So they put the drums on that and they started spinning it around, and they would lower him up and down. And it had this whole, it's also very vague and ambiguous what's going on, but it had the mood. And, you know, we got lucky for sure having him and his vision, because it holds up. It definitely does.
Yeah. And then it has this kind of dictator looking figure in it. And then at the end, you've got him hanging upside down.
Yes. Yeah. We showed him.
You got him.
Yeah, it was like a little mini epic. And we were fortunate to do a bunch of videos in the day where they had these concepts. I guess it's not so unusual anymore, of course. But back in the day, it was all new. And yeah, that was a fun experience, fun trip to England.
Do you guys have any idea what this first image in the video is meant to be? This guy kind of walks into a puddle and he has a bald head and he like kind of like almost like baptizes himself and then puts a hat on and then he's in the factory.
No,
that's lost to whatever the director was.
Yep. And we can't ask him.
Yeah. No, he had a vision and, for the whole thing and this whole cast of characters, as you see, it was just a mixed bag of extras.
Yeah.
And, pretty interesting stuff.
I mean, I grew up with all these sort of videos, you know, as a child in the '80s. And, you know, all these little vignettes, just these moments stick in my mind as having like significant meaning. And at the time it really just could have been like, oh, we've got this extra, just have him do this thing.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think there was a little baptizing going on and he's kind of the figure that leads you in and out of this cast of characters. I don't know.
I have a question. While we're on the topic of your videos from the mid 80s, And We Danced came out around the same time. Mm-hmm. So there at the very beginning, I think it's the very beginning. There's like an act. I guess there's actors playing, the two of you sitting at a bench playing.
They are indeed.
And then I think it's you guys later. So was there a significance or a reason behind that?
Well, first of all, we can tell you who they are because one is Rick Chertoff. The big bearded guy, he had a beard. I have to go back. Anyway, his name was Paul Prestipino. We call him Presto. He was the main tech at the Record Plant studio in New York where we did a lot of Nervous Night and also Cindy's album, and just a fantastic place. And he was like the guru guy. We used to call him Mr. Natural because he was. He's also an incredible musician, played with Peter Paul and Mary and a lot of other like folky bands. And we just loved him. He was always around when we were recording. So I don't know where the idea came from, Eric. Do you?
One of us thought of it. It definitely was an in-house idea. It was Rob or me that thought of it.
Anyway, that's Presto in the beginning, playing the mandolin, right? And he was a great mandolin player in reality. And the other guy is Rick Chertoff, who was our fantastic friend and producer, and did Cindy's album and Jones, as well as Nervous Night and a bunch of stuff for the band. So we thought, let's cast those guys. I really don't remember. It might have even been the director. Let's have them in the beginning playing the intro, which we looped and extended. And then Eric and I kind of take over the roles at the end. So it was like just a little visual cue. And it was fun to get Rick in there, who's behind the scenes of a lot of our music. And then Prestipino was just, and still is, a great friend of ours and just a great tech and great musician.
It might have been our little nod to Deliverance.
Sure, I can see that.
Cue the banjos.
Just the performance footage in this, is it all just lip synced, or is this an actual, like, did you guys actually get to perform?
It's lip synced.
Okay. I mean, it looks legit. Everything's mic'd up. Looks good.
You know what we did? We were playing though in between. That was one of the, I think holds up as one of the best videos we've done. The drive-in was closed. And it was like a ghost town. And then someone had this idea, a treatment, maybe it was a director, to go in there. It's in a place called Exton outside Philly. And it was like a Twilight Zone episode. I mean, they reopened it. They got the marquee. They got the lights on and everything kind of up and running again just for the video. We put out the word on the radio that we want volunteers to just come and, you know, be part of it. And boy, did they show up. In fact, they had to close it down. It was a whole scene in terms of just traffic jams and all that. People brought their cars. And we did play, though. We you know, because it's hurry up and wait when you do these videos. You do a quick scene, and they change the cameras, do it again. So there was a lot of downtime, and people just came and hung from the afternoon. It starts kind of late afternoon, goes into the evening. And we had a little PA, and we had equipment there. So in between the takes, we were actually playing live, you know, just kind of jamming and keeping people entertained. The video itself was, we were lip syncing to the track.
Gotcha.
But we were also playing while people were there. It was a big party.
Yeah, that's so cool.
It was. And you feel that in the video because it was legit. And as night went on and people got into more partying mood, it was caught. And now, you know, drive-ins, like so many things, are just so extinct these days that, I mean, I've had people come up and go, what, you know, kids or friends of my kids, like, what is that? And of course, once COVID hit, then I guess drive-ins came back into fashion.
Right.
But it was kind of a retro look, and now it's knocked down. It's a shopping center or something. I don't know.
There's so many people in this video. There's so many people there. It's incredible.
And a lot of them are still our friends.
That's sick.
Yeah.
I think we actually had the idea for the drive-in when we did an interview at a radio station in St. Louis, which was adjacent to a drive-in.
Yes, you're right. That is true.
And we thought, well, hey, why don't we do a video at a drive-in?
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm a good director. Got lucky. Got the setting. It poured the night before. I remember it was cold and rainy, and it was like, oh, boy, we're in trouble. Somehow it miraculously cleared up because it was that day or never. We couldn't really reschedule the whole crew and everything that was going on. And then the day turned out to be a beautiful day. And it was packed. It was a party. It was really, we caught something there.
The Vernon's in Levittown that you played at 5 nights a week, 4 sets a night.
Mm-hmm.
You would sometimes have a dance or skanking contest on stage. Let's hear about it.
Oh God. We had a dance contest to a particular song that Eric wants to re-record.
What was the song?
It's called Talk Too Much, and it was very much an English Beat vibe. And we would just play it. What was it? I think we gave out prizes. Was it endurance or technique?
It was technique, and it was totally random. We just decided who the winner was, and usually it was just a cute girl in the front.
Yeah. We would just play it for 20 minutes, and it was a goofy song, but it had a good beat. People loved it. And yes, the Skanking Army, they were skanking away.
And, you know, Rob mentioned the diversity of the audience. It really was amazing because there was this whole community of Jamaicans who would drive out to Levittown to see us. And they would be skanking next to the local bikers.
Yeah, it was a mixed crowd. And honestly, we look back and, you know, you're in the moment and you're just doing stuff that feels right. And you're not really thinking much beyond that moment. And just like, wow, we're actually playing clubs and doing what we've always dreamed of doing and supporting ourselves. And the people were just coming from kind of all the areas, exactly. And they were having fun. They weren't quite sure what they were hearing, but they were digging it. And we would literally write a song, play it that night, write another one, a couple of days off. Let's write some more, try it. You know, this worked, that didn't work. Throw in this, take out that. It was just nonstop. Play all night, sleep all day, then do it the next night, that kind of thing. Living and breathing it totally and plugging the material as fast as we could.
Okay, so you guys played with Cyndi Lauper. You backed Cyndi Lauper on her album, She's So Unusual. Now, kind of tell me about this. Now, as I understand it, you guys were sort of taking a hiatus when this happened.
We were, yeah. In fact, she came to see us. Well, the quick story, somewhat quick, is Rick Chertoff, our good buddy, was assigned. At this point, he was a staff producer. He was originally a drummer in a college band that I had and some other bands. And then he moved on from drumming to producing and quite successfully. And then he was assigned to produce a solo artist named Cyndi Lauper. Her band, Blue Angel, had, I guess, broken up and she was assigned to do solo. And he wanted to kind of have a band for her. And we were playing, this original version of the band was playing at the Bottom Line in New York. He brought Cyndi to see us. And she was kind of digging the scene as well. You know, she was coming more from a punky, new wave, alternative version. I don't know how to describe it. She was Cyndi. But she liked the ska reggae-ness of what we were doing. And we were on a hiatus. At that point, we'd been playing a couple years consistently and we were a little burned out and, you know, we thought it was time for a break and timing was such that Cyndi, Eric, you can fill in the blanks too. But I think during this period, and we eventually regrouped and did this album Memoria. But before we did that, Cyndi came along and that was a side project that was interesting to all of us. And she liked that influence and there was a lot of it on her first album.
We actually recorded a version of Fightin' on the same side with her.
Oh, nice. Really?
The two-tone ska thing, she was getting that as well, bringing it to her own filter. And again, she saw us, you know, perform it. We played the Bottom Line a couple times in New York, which was a big deal for us to get out of Philly and, you know, hit the city, the big city. And it really clicked. And then she started coming down to Philly, actually, to our place in Manioc to write and record demos for her album.
Fine, on the same side, that was one of your demos you recorded with her that I assume never was released?
We actually recorded it with her in the studio, but it did not make the album.
Yeah.
Interesting.
I wonder if there's a record. There's got to be a copy of that somewhere.
Yeah, for sure.
You worked with her for like, I want to say like 4 or 5 months demoing before you even went in the studio?
Easily, yep. In fact, I just found all of my Porta Studio tapes from that.
Oh.
Yeah, we did 4-track demos of all that. Rick was the ringleader, Rick Chertoff. He had a bunch of songs in mind, most notably Girls Just Want to Have Fun. And we must have done, I don't know, countless demos of that song because it was kind of a punk rock song by this guy, Robert Hazard, who was kind of our competition back in the day. We did a number of shows with him and he was just straight rock. And we were doing our thing. And then somehow it's very ironic or coincidental that it morphed from his song into our world. And after many, many tries, we kind of ended up with the version that people know, which is a little more with the upbeats and kind of syncopated reggae style. So we were working on demos all through the night. Was another one that Rick had from the very beginning, and Witness and
Money Changes Everything. Rick brought that in.
Yeah. So they had a bunch of songs, and then we were the hired hand, so to speak.
So Witness, if you listen to Witness as it exists on the album, it actually sounds very ska. For some reason, I never really noticed that.
Yeah.
That's my understanding that she wrote that, right? Am I right in that?
I think she wrote that with, Jules Shear? Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, she wanted to be involved in the writing process. And, you know, it was kind of a push and pull there because Rick was really spearheading he was leading the charge here with songs that they had imagined for her. He had imagined. And then, of course, when we came in the picture, musically, it started to take shape with this ska influence. Not completely, but there was a fair amount on the record. And she dug that. And like Eric said, she did fight. And I think there were other outtakes, too. There were a lot of things, of course, that never saw the light of day, just little jams here and there. But that's what we were playing in our band, and she was a fan.
To your knowledge, what was her familiarity with ska when you first started writing and getting together?
I don't know. I think the entrance for a lot of the, I don't know if it was the ska as much as the reggae, but the Police were I keep coming back to them because they were, to me, they had their, you know, they were finger right on the sound. You know, it was like, let's take the reggae stuff, the drumming, the vocals, the approaches, it just had all those elements. So I think they were leading the way commercially. And then we kind of turned her on to the two-tone stuff. I'm not sure she was familiar with it or not. She was coming from, you know, the Village, New York, maybe a little CBGB's, more of like a punk rock kind of place. Mm-hmm. And where the, you know, it was a punky reggae party, basically.
So the original version of Girls Just Want to Have Fun, you were talking about Robert Hazard and the Heroes. It's like, yep, a power pop song.
Yep.
She did not like this song at all, right?
She hated it. Quote, I will never I will never sing that song, quote unquote.
That effing song.
The original kind of comes off maybe a little sexist. Is that sort of?
Yeah, it's demeaning to women, she'd say.
Yeah.
Yeah, great story there. I mean, the short story that has become kind of a legend is that Rick did have, you know, he found the song. I think it was even new to us. I mean, we knew Hazard, but it wasn't, he had some big local hits. That wasn't really one of them, at least on my radar. But Rick brought her down to see them, to see Robert Hazard and his band, and they started playing it. And a guy with straight eighth notes, real punk rock, and a girl just want to have fun. And his deep baritone, and she's like, I'm not singing that freaking song. and Rick said, you know, in this moment of incredible wisdom, something like, yeah, but in your hands, you know, if a girl sings that song, and if we can find a way in to turn and twist some things around, it could be anthemic. And damn, he was right about that. So it was a little bit of a struggle. It was a great moment of just creative friction.
We did many versions of that song.
Many versions. But she came around. I mean, he was so persistent.
I'll tell you what the moment was. We came in one day and we were talking about Come On Eileen. Now, everybody loved Come On Eileen, which is one of the greatest records ever made. Rick came over and said, well, can you sing Girls Just Want to Have Fun like Come On Eileen?
Hmm.
Are we here? And I took it upon myself to program a beat in my 808 drum machine, like Come On Eileen, boom, ba-dum, boom, ba-dum. And I picked up a guitar and I played. And she started singing it. And by the end of the day, she was saying, I always wanted to sing that song. It's so empowering to women.
I don't know if it happened that day. It happened, but that part did. She came around. I mean, you know, yes, that was. And then we added some upbeats. You know, I had this like a farfisa or a box organ with a delay. So the reggae-ness, you know, it's not a reggae per se, but there's upbeats going around. And
there's a demo of it that's a more pronounced,
yes,
version of it.
Yeah,
exactly. And then we were doing a lot with the 808 drum machine. Exactly. And then it's always been that. It's been kind of a combination of my keyboards and Eric's guitars. And, you know, he had the rock and riff. I'm just playing the upbeats with this delay, and it started to come together. But there was a lot of push and pull in that. And, you know, sometimes it works better than others. But in this case, it really worked. And it did become her anthem. And it got noticed. We weren't sure where it was going.
That guitar riff is so good. Thanks for playing that.
Yeah.
So there's a keyboard solo in that song. I think everyone probably knows it by heart.
Yeah.
Yes.
So I read that it you had your Roland Juno 60, and that was the steel drum sound effect.
It was indeed.
Dude, that is a crazy sound.
All the patches are numbered. I think it was number 73 or something. They're all, on that record, it was all Juno all the time. I had just gotten it. Actually, I was playing it in the Hooters as well, early 80s. It was just the synth that came along that I could afford and play. I'm not a technical programmer, and that is one of the best keyboards ever because it's got everything right on board, as opposed to like a TX-7 or some of these synths that are somewhat complicated. This had sliders and knobs. You can just twiddle, but even the presets, most of that album, at least Cindy's album, was just straight out of the box presets. And that was one of them. That steel drum thing kind of happened. It was a quick one.
Those swipes at the end of that solo, what is that?
There's a pitch bend, a little bender. And then it's also, there's an arpeggiator that was such a, still is. In fact, Eric's got one. We were just playing it last week. So the arpeggiator just triggers these random, you know, repeated or arpeggiated notes. And then I landed on the steel drum, and it was straight out of the, you know, Calypso, not even reggae. It was really even more Calypso in my mind, going back to the early ska and Mento days, whatever that stuff was. Somehow it spoke to me. And that very end, you hit the note, and then you just hit the pitch bend, the little joystick, which you can adjust for different parameters. But it was actually, I guess it's kind of changing the filter a little bit. So if it wasn't one take, it was two at the most. It was really quick and spontaneous. And the pitch bender, the Juno 60 is just best synth ever for that stuff anyway.
The out on that solo, just that those last three notes of the solo crack me up every time. Because it just sounds like, yep, next part. I love it.
Well, there's a cartoony element. There's humor in there, I know. And there was,
yeah, it's amazing. It's so good.
Yeah. Well, so that whole album, I mean, I have to say, it was a work album, and Cindy's a tough taskmaster, but she's also very funny. There's a humor. I mean, look, She's So Unusual, you know, the title song, you hear it right away. And there was humor on that record and on that song, and it was fun. And that thing just kind of took it over the top, even in the ride out when we did the solo. Then it was like, yeah, let's do some more in the end. Those are all little random blips, and I'm just twiddling, you know, the joystick and knobs and things as we go in real time. And it was fun. Yeah, it fit. Really fit.
So time after time, this song started out faster and more of an overt like reggae element.
Yeah, I mean, I wish we've been looking recently and even farther behind for old cassettes or Walkman's tapes or something. We wrote that in the studio, and so it was at the very end of the project. And we, you know, unlike all the demos that we've been talking about, which it was really a work record, especially Girls, and Eric was doing these 4-track demos that were really tremendous versions. Time was just the last song. Rick said, hey, we could use one more song, and we actually wrote that in the studio. And so a demo doesn't even really exist, but it started out a little bouncier, and I was just doing these upbeats over the chorus changes. I don't have the keyboard like Eric has a guitar, but basically, time after time after time, we landed on that hook around the chords, and it was just dancey and up more up feeling, and then over time it slowed down to become, you know, what it is, what it was and is today, but just a kind of deeper, slower mood.
I read that when you first played it for her, she just started dancing in the studio.
Yeah, well, she would kind of channel, that's, you know, just kind of trance out on stuff and move around. And, you know, it's a while ago, so it's hard to really remember, except that she came in with the title, which was a movie, sci-fi movie. She got it out of TV Guide, and the late, great TV Guide. And I know that's true. And then it was just a matter of singing and playing it. And we went right into the studio and just threw it up, and with Bill Whitman Engineering and Eric and Rick Chertoff, we all just put it together. That record is the demo. I mean, that's the beautiful thing. I mean, we went right to the multi-track. We were working 24 track back then, and Eric had the drum machine. We overdubbed a very simple drum part. Eric, what was that? That was Anton that came in, right?
Yeah, but originally we programmed it on the Lynn drum, and Anton just replaced the kick and snare and side stick.
Anton Fink played drums. Yeah, and it was just very sparse and basic. But yeah, it went from up-tempo to being kind of the more moody record, which really fit the vibe. And her vocal was the same thing. If it wasn't a first take, it was one of the first. It was very early on. She sang it, and it just came together, kind of as Zombies did. I mean, in terms of the writing, it was just a quick process. In this case, we really didn't have time or budget or energy to do much more. We were really at the end of the project and pretty exhausted, to be honest.
And so she came in with Time After Time. It's my understanding that it was a placeholder name that just never got changed.
Yes. She came in. I just started singing that Time After Time over those changes, little bouncier beat. And I think it was kind of a placeholder. You know, we weren't sure. It didn't strike us as the most original title. And there was at least one well-known, maybe other songs with that title. So sometimes, you know, the title, like All You Zombies, felt like, okay, that's something different. But Time After Time, we were just singing it. It felt good. And yeah, it was a bit of a placeholder. And then as it went by, as time went on, we didn't replace it. You know, that was it.
And so the original tempo got slowed down because of the content of her lyrics. Is that true?
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, I just remember sitting, we wrote it at the piano in the record plant, literally in the studio, and just sitting at the piano, bouncing away. And then somehow it became this, it slowed down, and then it went to the Juno pad number 61 in your songbook. These are all presets, kids. So just get your Juno and have fun. great secrets. But once we found the pad with the Lynn drum, this shaker kind of giving us the time element, it was the clock ticking kind of thing. I mean, and even that side stick that comes in, the clock ticks, all of that. The pad was the foundation. And once we landed on that beautiful Juno pad, I mean, those are all just out of the box sounds. That just was the world. But that's one of those records that there's not a lot of development per se from verse to chorus to bridge. I mean, things happen, but that pad goes the whole way. It's just this bed for the whole record. And once we found that and her voice and the guitars, it came together as a foundation, Cindy singing over that, that was just beautiful. It didn't need a lot more. And it's a pretty sparse record.
And so there is no bass in the verse, right? The bass is only in the chorus.
That's right.
Yeah. No, it's just the low notes. The Juno chorus was the trick there. And the low notes, it's just, there's bass, but it's just these held notes, but there's no bass really. Right. The bass line enters on the chorus, and that was it.
Because I read her saying that the intention of that song was to have a reggae bass line.
Which it does. That is a very reggae bass line.
Yeah, I don't know if that was the intention. It's what happened. I mean, I remember clearly we had the record and the chorus was kind of came late in the process. And the bass, Eric, maybe that was one of the last things you can tell. One of the last things we did, I think.
The guitars were the last, I think.
And the guitars. And the reggae for me, I mean, that was a synth bass. And I always heard it as that, you know, it was like, let's throw in a little reggae line, whatever that is, whatever that implies. So the track doesn't feel like that, but the bass definitely has that.
Yes. That melodic kind of a bass thing that it has a voice of its own, exists separately from the rest of the track, but integrates so beautifully. Mm-hmm. I remember the first, they played me their first sketch of that song. And, I was moved to tears. It was really the first time in my life I'd heard a song, and I knew that we were going to hear it for the rest of our lives.
Mm. Now, when you got brought on to this project, so Cindy's a new artist. She had a band, but she's still like, she's a new artist. You guys are like basically like a club band at this point when you're brought on. Was the intention that this was going to be a big pop record, or were they hedging their bets on it? Just like, we'll see what happens.
Good question. You know what? I don't know. And I think Rick, we were very secluded. And I think having Rick in our corner and being a great old dear friend of ours, rather than some staff producer that comes in is like, okay, guys, you know, see you 9 to 5. We lived and breathed together. We became a little band, which is really what Rick and Cindy were looking for as well. We were all band guys. She could have went and she could have hired studio cats, as we call them, and just to come in and play. But the very, just the creation of that whole record was, again, in Philly with Eric doing 4-track demos. And I don't know what the intention was. And I remember finishing the album thinking, who's going to play this record? It's like all over the place. It opens with Money Changes Everything, which is like this punk rock song. Then you had a Prince cover. You had Girls, which didn't sound like anything else on the record. You had Time. You had All Through the Night, which is a beautiful ballad. Then you had some ska things. It was really somewhat scattered, and that's why I'm not an A&R guy, because sure. Next thing you know, she had like 4, and Shebop, which had its own thing. She had 4 top 5 singles on that record, but I don't know what the intention was. They obviously heard and saw her as a dynamic performer, and if you look at old videos, there's some great stuff out of her with Blue Angel, and she was clearly a force, you know, to be reckoned with. I mean, she was all over the stage. She was singing, dancing, jumping, yelling, you know, climbing up wherever she could, going into the audience. She had that element in the live sense. So I think making a record was really a challenge. It's like, what kind of artist is she going to be? You know, how will she be molded? And she's not easily molded into anything.
She will not be molded.
She will not be molded. So it was kind of, every day was a challenge, you know, like we land on something, it felt really good. And the next day she'd come in and goes, no, it's all wrong. And, you know, I was like, okay. And we just kept trying, but honestly, it was a testament to everybody's perseverance. And really Rick in particular, because Rick is very laid back and we're very emotional and, you know, we're fighting for our territory. Like, no, it goes like this, it goes like that, et cetera. And Rick's just sitting there listening and going, okay, but how about this? You know, how about that? And he was really a great leader on that project, and Bill too on the engineering, and even John Aniello, who was the assistant engineer, still was a great producer as well. We had such a great team. So the sounds on that record, the production, the performances, the music, it's all over the place. And she nailed it.
Yeah, in my mind, that's the record that really tied together the sort of the punk, new wave, ska, underground stuff with mainstream pop music of the 80s. Mm-hmm. Like, I can't really think of a record that bridges all of those so well and then did so commercially, was so commercially successful as that particular record. I mean,
it's true.
You know, Prince came from, I would say, a little different world, and he bridged those elements to mainstream pop. I'm not sure if I would really make the same claim to Madonna, even though she did come from the punk underground, because you can really still hear the elements in She's So Unusual. They're still there.
Yeah.
And let's not forget that MTV came along, and all of a sudden the timing was just really, you know, the planets aligned, as we always say, and sometimes they don't. But in this case, she was so perfect for that medium. You know, like, here's music videos. And the girls in all of her videos, she was styling and directing and really had such an influence in those with her look, with her vibe, the visual element and the performance element all came together too. So that when you heard Girls and then you saw the video and all the others that followed, she just ran with that. And she was just, and still is, she was perfect for that, because the she had a lot of references in the visual side, as well as, you know, the audio and musical, and they all came together for an artist like her and for us, you know, I mean, the 80s sounds, we had our bag, but she opened it up to a very wide palette.
I want to connect this to your release of Amore. Mm. So, cause it's kind of around the same time.
Right after, it was kind of our next step. You know, we started playing again. After we finished that album, we kind of...
So you kind of got reinvigorated, or you just had enough of a break to give it another go?
We got reinvigorated. We made some changes in the band and started doing some...
Ironically, we got a couple of players from Robert Hazard. Robert Hazard fired his band and we decided to get back together. And we got 2 players that they were our competition, and now they defected and they came and joined us.
Fire sale.
One of whom, John Louie, has been with us ever since. Sick. And then... Rob Miller, bass player, who came and went, but he's still a friend of ours as well. But Yeah, we kind of reunited with some of them and then decided, hey, let's, yeah, exactly. We were re-energized, shall we say, invigorated, exactly.
Now, was Amore on a major or indie label? I can't recall.
It was our label. We made a label. It was totally self-financed. We did it in like a month in a studio in Philadelphia, and it was awesome.
Was there a point when the success of Cindy impacted your success, or at least putting you on the radar of major labels?
There was. In fact, we were really at this point, especially when we got back together, and even before, even in the early 80s with the first version of the band, we were really kicking it in Philly, you know, 100 miles from New York. But I always say we might as well have been in Montana, because the record labels were like, come to New York, come to New York. And we're like, come to Philly. So, and we did go to New York a few times, had a few disastrous gigs. We had a few okay gigs. Fortunately, the bottom line was a good one, but they were not that interested in coming to Philly. And then after Cindy, at least as I recall, and after we did Amore, we started playing bigger clubs and kind of packing them. And finally, and with Rick really as a, you know, front runner here, leading the way, he and some other A&R guys, I guess, came down into a club in Philly, saw the band, and we moved on from the indie world to Columbia.
Rick really was our guardian angel.
Yeah, it was tough getting them down here, but they came.
Amore to me musically sounds, you know, still similar to the first version of the band.
Yep.
Whereas the Nervous Night, that's your Columbia
yep.
debut record, does sound like a bit different at this point, like a bit like bigger. Everything sounds much bigger mm-hmm. and fuller and more like more for arenas almost.
Yeah. Well, you know, that Rick really had a lot to do with that. And Bill Whitman, who just recorded everything amazingly well. But, you know, because when we started playing with the Hooters, it was a bit of a sacrifice musically for me and Rob, because we were shredders, you know. I was playing, you know, I wish I'd been getting paid by the note, you know, kind of solos. And I was, you know, playing my Les Paul through Marshall, and it was awesome. But, with the Hooters doing the ska and reggae thing, some of that had to go, you know. And, you know, same thing with Rob, who's, you know, his brilliant piano suites and sweeping Hammond organ solos. We kind of had to, it kind of had to take a back seat for a while. And then Rick at one point said, Eric, how would you feel about turning that guitar back up? And at first I was kind of resistant. I didn't really want to go back to, you know, just being another rock band. Cause no, you know, we're a ska and reggae band, but, you know, we kind of met in the middle and I think created something different. And that was around the same time as we brought in the mandolin and later the accordion. So we started to, you know, bring in some of the folky elements as well.
Now, when the version of All You Zombies that's on Nervous Night, no, what I read was that the thought process behind how you were going to capture that song for this record was to do a Pink Floyd The Walls version of that song.
Yes. What would Roger do?
What would Roger do?
No, absolutely. And that's, we spent a lot of time working on that. And it paid off, because when we played in London a couple of years later, Roger Waters came to our show and said, "Hi, I'm your fan."
Nice.
And then in 2 years after that, he invited us to the Wall.
Yeah, it's been a long and winding road, and predating the Hooters and now, and even recently kind of going back to the ska roots. But Rick, by the time the Columbia record, it was 84, 85 after Cindy. And it was like, okay, guys, let's make, you said it, a bigger, fuller sound, and definitely a more, I don't want to say mainstream, but I guess it was more of a rock sound. And Zombies was a song which we, to this day, we still toy with arrangements. There was the original 45 that was a live version. Then we changed it for Amore. We did yet another version. And that one just kept hanging in there as this nagging song that wouldn't go away in a good way. And Rick said he heard a bigger kind of epic production. I don't know if Pink Floyd was mentioned right away, but it kind of was an influence. He just heard it in a different way. It still has some reggae-ness to it. There's still the bass line and there's some upbeats, but it's not the funky reggae song that it was in the early days. And that one made a transition to this day that is just, that's the arrangement. You know, it's just this kind of big, heavy song. And then it led to other things. And then we started touring overseas. And the band sound, as Eric mentioned, we added, you know, accordions and penny whistles and mandolins and mandolas and other instruments and sounds. That's part of the show. And we do most of our touring now overseas. And it's become a sound that just people, they get and they like it. And the ska thing is kind of full circle now because we're really coming back around to some of that stuff. And we're going to go back on tour next summer. And it'll be fun to reintroduce or introduce that sound to some of the fans because they've never even really heard it, including some of our road crew. You know, we'd be on the tour bus and they found this Emerald City recording, for example, one of our backline guys. And it's like, guys, what's this all about? But they loved it. They got it, especially in Europe, because that stuff is always more prominent, you know, than it was here. But it's a sound that nobody really associates with us. So it'll be something interesting to see how that goes.
Yeah, people have, you know, mixed ska with different sounds or have, you know, had different kinds of songs that they played as well as ska. But I think like this arena rock, 80s arena rock sound is not something that it seems like a different path.
And we were never that. We never really, I mean, we opened for some arena rock bands and we could pass, but that's not what we really were.
Yeah, I mean, you're a very diverse band. I agree. And especially you can really see that in the instrumentations that you play with. That definitely is an indicator of your eclecticness as a musicians and songwriters.
But in defense of ska, as you're saying, it's kind of true. It never did get to the mainstream arena stage that I can think of. I mean, there were, and I think like another, I think we played with Fishbone. We played with some of those songs. Sublime, you know, there's been bands along the way that have had their finger on it.
No doubt. Definitely no doubt.
No doubt, for sure. But, you know, it never really entered. And it's interesting. I don't know why it doesn't lend itself to that. It's very danceable. It's very musical. It's, you know, it's got all the elements, but it's true. I mean, it's not something that has kind of crossed into that, the arena, so to speak. I'm not sure.
So in the mid-80s, you have All You Zombies, And We Danced, Day by Day, Where Do the Children Go? What song in that time period was the biggest hit?
Chart-wise, I think Day by Day, actually.
Day by Day was the biggest charting hit at the time?
Yep.
We didn't really have charting hits. It's strange. We've played, we keep thinking we've just forced these songs down throats in the ears of our audience because they weren't like, and we danced to me. I mean, that's just a top 40 hit. We close the shows with that. It's a rock and it's just a great pop song. It just is, in all honesty, but it wasn't a hit. And I don't even think Day by Day was a top 10 hit. The album went double platinum. You know, it was back in what they called AOR, album oriented radio, and it was FM stations, but we weren't getting top 40 airplay. And to this day, like on SiriusXM, they have their 80s channel, and we don't get airplay on that channel either, and mainly because I guess we didn't have those hits. But everybody knows them, and we've been playing them for decades, and, you know, no hard feelings, but hey, where were they when we, you know, could have used
it? Yeah.
But, you know, we sold albums, and we sold tickets, and I think that's the other side of it, is from the very beginning and until the very end, it was and is a live band. I mean, the recordings are one thing, but the shows are something else, and even the recordings, we play pretty much note for note, but the other songs have really evolved and changed, and it is a live band, and it's always been a live band. That was kind of the concept from the beginning. After Baby Grand, with a couple studio albums that just never really went anywhere, in fact, we just clearly made a decision not even to record for a while, just go out and play and write and try to build up a sound. And all the early 45s and through more, it was just self, you know, DIY, self-financed indie records. That's where we were going. That's what was happening in Philly and a lot of places. And that was the path. And when we finally went back to the major labels, the more corporate side of things, the sound changed, but our attitude never changed. And fortunately with Rick, it didn't have to, because we had our, as Eric said, we had our you know, secret agent in there to kind of shield us from the suits, as it were. And maybe that was, you know, to our detriment too sometimes. I don't know.
I read in like a Google or Yahoo group, so if you remember the show, September 85, Hooters opened for Cyndi Lauper at Mann Music Center. And I think that's in Philly. I'm not sure.
Yes.
Yep.
Yes.
Do you remember this? Because a couple details from that show, Rob, you sang Time After Time with her on stage.
I did.
And then the band and Cyndi performed Fighting on the same side together.
Wow. That was we both wowed.
I could be. I don't remember. I mean, we did play it with her. We did, as Merrick mentioned, as Eric said before, we recorded it. We were hoping it would have been awesome if that had been on our album. But I don't remember that, but we could have. We opened for her at the Man. It's a shed. It's a big outdoor kind of amphitheater. It's still there, a beautiful place. And that was really we played there a number of times. We played there with In Excess. And I want to say the B-52s. I could be wrong. The
Go-Go's.
The Go-Go's, yes.
Oh, you know what? We also did play. We played with the B-52s.
I think so. Yep. And you know, it definitely played with Cyndi, though, because we opened and then we jammed with her. And yes, that was really a fun gig. We were reunited at that one.
Yeah, so Time After Time, we forgot to mention this during the discussion about the song, but Rob, you're on the recording, right, as backing vocal?
I am, yeah. That was another placekeeper. We just went so fast that I was singing the harmony on the chorus, and I figured, well, they'll get the real singers in at some point, because she was, I mean, she's such an awesome singer. And vocally, although we were doing some backgrounds, and obviously on the demos, we did a lot of harmonizing with her. And on that one, it just kind of came as a reference part, as really most of that record was, until we got to the final, you know, fine tuning of it. But we were singing, and she wanted to keep it, because my voice is kind of I'm just a rough rock singer. I'm not Cyndi, or who is, but she liked the sound of it, and she kept it. So that was all reference stuff.
Nice. So you can remember the show. You do remember playing Time After Time on stage. Did that happen very often?
No, I think that might have been. Well, I've sung it with her in a number of shows. I think that was the only time we opened for her. Eric, do you remember? I don't.
That was, but then didn't we do that show on Chestnut Street where those pictures come from? Didn't she play it?
Oh no! We played at Temple University.
Right.
Yes, we did a show. But was that our show, or did we sit in?
I think we sat in with her. I think it was her show.
Yeah, it was her show. There's some pictures, but I have some pictures from that from the Mann Music Center as well. We have done a few things, but I think that was the only time the Hooters really shared a stage with her. But over the years, you know, we've definitely interacted and sat in, et cetera.
Yeah, it's been cool to like watch some of the later footage, you know, whether it's like late '80s or '90s or whatever. And she really brings in a lot of like reggae and ska and stuff into her songs, and she redoes some of these songs in those vein, in that vein. Yeah.
I think she did another version of Girl and some other things. Exactly. She was a fan. I don't know if we introduced it to her or not. Certainly some of the ska stuff, we were deep into that. And I think we were, you know, early on, because it does go way back into our, you know, some of the clubs and that we were going to and the records we were listening to. But she picked up on it, and she was a fan for sure.
There, we actually recorded a version of that with Sly and Robbie.
Really?
Yeah.
When was this?
This was while we were making the record. We actually flew them in from Jamaica to have them play when Girls Just Want to Have Fun. We just thought that they were going to bring that magic thing that they have into it, and you know, it would make it the real authentic ska reggae thing. And Robbie's bass hadn't made it, so he played my bass. He played on my precision bass, which I still have. And we did actually record a version of it, and it just never caught fire.
Wow.
That is true. It came in. We were just like, wow. I mean, these were already idols of ours. I mean, we were going for something very authentic, and went to some trouble and expense to make that happen. And unfortunately, it just didn't. It, you know, they weren't. it wasn't, you know, you can tell when it's grooving or when it's not. They weren't feeling it. We weren't. Cindy was kind of in the middle of it. And, you know, we spent an afternoon. It was thrilled to meet them and kind of jam. In fact, I remember they walked in and Eric, if you remember, we were big fans of Ijah Man. I don't know if you guys are familiar with the Ijah Man records, but Ijah Man was a solo artist. I think he was on Island, and they're beautiful, beautiful records. Just fantastic. Reggae and beyond, very just long, these hymnal tracks. And so we were playing, we were listening to that. We were listening to Linton Kwesi Johnson. A lot of the British stuff, the Jamaican stuff. And we started jamming on Ijah Man and with Sly and Robbie. And I was like, in heaven, this is like, you know, put the headphones on and there they are. And, you know, it was kind of trying to get some momentum. But as far as the feel for Girls, it was the whole way. That was a work song. It just never came easily. And it didn't come easily that day. We you know, we cut some tracks. They came and went, and it just wasn't meant to be.
Were they just there for the one day?
Yeah, they flew out the next day. And we were playing this Ijah Man thing, which had this beautiful arpeggiated guitar thing and this great organ thing. And when we, you know, we were playing it, then they started playing. And when we stopped, they said, "That's really nice. What is that?"
Yeah, well, you know, they didn't play on everything.
Yeah, but just about. No, they played on that. They did play on that.
I think they did.
Yeah, they definitely did. I just think they play on everything. So it's kind of like.
Yeah.
I mean, I forget half the things I've played on.
Sure.
Now I'm just going to be thinking about this alternative universe where Girls Just Want to Have Fun was played by Sly and Robbie.
There has to be. I don't have tapes of that. Do you, Eric?
I don't.
That's something that must exist somewhere.
I think that was a mercy erasure.
Don't go anywhere. If you want to hear the rest of this conversation, head over to our Patreon. Thank you for listening to In Defense of Ska. Please rate and review this podcast and tell a friend. Follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok at In Defense of Ska. Pick up Aaron's book, In Defense of Ska, at your local bookstore or online. This podcast is edited by Chris Reeves of Ska Punk International. This is your co-host, Adam Davis of Omnigon, leaving you by saying ska now more than ever.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.